This is Taking Aim with
Roush Ohnmen
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. Part 4, The Padilla Verdict, Exposing the Facade of the Rule of Law. On Monday morning, August 27th, 2007, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez issued a very brief statement without taking any questions from the media. He said he would step down from being the U.S. Attorney General effective September 17th. On Friday, the previous Friday, he had telephoned President Bush at his Crawford Ranch to tell him the news that he was stepping down. But despite the media buzz, he waited until Monday morning to make the statement official. The immediate context of Gonzalez's departure, according to Joe Kay, writing for the Worldwide Socialist Web on August 28th, was the tension between the White House and Congress over a purge of the 9 U.S. attorneys in 2006 and the expansion of the domestic spying programs under the Bush administration, that is, the secret wiretapping, the exposure that had appeared in December 2005 in the New York Times of the massive extent of the National Security Administration wiretapping program. In testimony before Congress, Kay writes, on these matters, Gonzalez had made repeated statements that were contradicted by other current and former government officials, and the Democratic Party members had begun calling for a special prosecutor to look into charges of perjury. Leading Republicans also called for Gonzalez's resignation. We bring up the resignation of U.S. Attorney Gonzalez, who had previously been the White House counsel, and before that, when President Bush was governor of Texas, had been his legal representative. We bring this up today in the context of discussing the verdict about a week before of Jose Padilla in a Florida court. In February of 2004, then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez told a meeting of the American Bar Association that citizens who take up arms against the United States don't deserve legal counsel. This is a surprising statement from an attorney who was also a counsel to the president at the time and later became the head attorney, the head prosecutor for the United States, the U.S. Attorney General. And here he was in February 2004 saying that U.S. citizens don't deserve legal counsel. To be specific, he said, any individual rights, quote, must give way to the national security needs of this country to gather intelligence from captured enemy combatants, end quote. But he also added, quote, the stream of intelligence would quickly dry up if the enemy combatants were allowed contact with outsiders during the course of an ongoing debriefing. The result would be the failure to uncover information that could prevent attacks, end quote. He further clarified what he meant, quote, this is an intolerable cost, and we do not believe it is one required by the Constitution. I repeat, this is U.S. The White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, who later became the U.S. Attorney General, stating, it is an intolerable cost, that is, having contact, legal counsel, or contact with outsiders during a so-called debriefing, and we do not believe it is one required by the Constitution. Ralph?
I think it's important, since we're discussing Gonzalez, to identify what it is that was the basis for Democratic Party objection to the role of Gonzalez. We have to keep in mind that Gonzalez played a key role in the firing of U.S. attorneys and that those attorneys that were fired were investigating a specific undertaking in which Republican Party operatives would file trumped-up voter fraud cases against Democratic candidates and voter registration groups allied with the Democratic Party in order to remove Democratic Party voters from registration lists. In other words, they were Gonzalez was undertaking, through the purging of these U.S. attorneys, an avoidance operation to prevent them from investigating the cooking of elections. That is the real heart of the matter with respect to Democratic Party opposition to Gonzalez. Remember, Gonzalez was the key figure in drafting the memoranda that allowed the president to violate international law, democratic rights. He drafted a memo that the Geneva Conventions could not be applied to U.S. enemies or to enemy combatants or to those sympathizing with Al-Qaeda and Taliban on the basis of the designation by the Attorney General himself. He called those Geneva Conventions quaint. He requested the torture memo, which defined torture in such a fashion as to allow all forms of both physical and psychological torture. None of this served as the basis for the objections to Gonzalez. In fact, as Bush stated himself, Gonzalez played the critical role in shaping our policies in the war on terror, the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, and all the other important laws bear his imprint. And that's the point. The Military Commissions Act was passed in 2006 with the full connivance of the Democratic congressional leaders. It eliminated habeas corpus for prisoners at Guantanamo. It gave the president the right to scrap the Geneva Conventions. It established the system of drumhead military commissions to replace the courts. All of that, the work of Gonzalez, was unopposed by the Democratic Party. He played the key role in confirming the Supreme Court Justices John Roberts and Samuel Alito, who were designed to sanction this liquidation of formal democratic rights. Indeed, none of the fundamental issues of democratic rights were the focus of the attacks upon Gonzalez by the Democratic Party. They downplayed those questions about manipulating elections. They downplayed all the illegalities and the unconstitutionality of the spying programs which the Democrats facilitated. Indeed, the principal concern of the congressional Democrats was that Gonzalez was an obstacle to the functioning of the Justice Department with the collusion and cooperation of the Democratic Party. And that is the gravamen of what is now on the record as the intended replacement of Gonzalez. Here we have it. The person who is designated as the most likely replacement is Michael Chertoff. Chertoff, the head of the Department of Homeland Security. Chertoff, who is very deeply involved in the false flag operation of 9/11 itself. And the key point about this, Maya, is that the Democratic Senator Schumer, who played the leading role in the investigations into Gonzalez, has stated that the Democrats were prepared to support the nomination of Michael Chertoff to head the Justice Department. And that tells us all, brothers and sisters, that is the real significance of the removal of the facade, of which the Padilla case is the clearest and most brutal example.
Well, let's look, Ralph, at the case of Jose Padilla. On Thursday, August 16th, Jose Padilla, who initially had been designated as an enemy combatant by the Justice Department in 2002, when he was returning to the United States from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and he had been seized in Chicago, and he had been first put as a witness, held as a supposed witness for a grand jury investigation. But then, after that wasn't working out, he was declared by President Bush as an enemy combatant. He has first been confined. He was locked in solitary confinement in New York City for a month, and then he was taken into military custody, actually on the eve of a scheduled court hearing that would have required the government to justify in legal terms his continued detention. Instead, President Bush had declared Jose Padilla an enemy combatant and said he posed, quote, a continuing president and grave danger, end quote, to U.S. national security. The president said that Padilla had possessed intelligence information that could help prevent al-Qaeda attacks on the United States. Then Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz told the CBS Early Show that Padilla, quote, was in the very early stages of his planning. And Wolfowitz admitted at that time that he didn't think there was actually a plot, but there was some fairly loose talk. Well, that supposed loose talk later led to Padilla being incarcerated in a Navy brig for 43 months, held in solitary confinement in secret conditions. At first, no one was aware of what was happening to him. Later, it was revealed that Padilla had been subjected to heinous torture, not just solitary confinement, but torture, as we have discussed in great detail on prior Taking Aim programs. But on August 16th, Padilla was convicted in a courtroom in Florida. How that took place, it had nothing to do with any of the original reasons for seizing Padilla in terms of a dirty bomb. The case of Padilla's being held wound its way through the Supreme Court. First, the Supreme Court rejected the case on a technical matter, saying that the case should have been filed in South Carolina. When the case was refiled, the case for his being held without reason, the court, as it wound its way back up to the Supreme Court, once again going through the lower courts first and then up to the Supreme Court, after it was about to reach the Supreme Court, the government shifted its approach and charged Padilla in Florida, along with two other co-defendants, Adham Amin Hassoun and Kifa Wa'il Jalousi. Eventually, they were convicted on two counts of material support for terrorism and one count of conspiracy to murder, kidnap, and maim people overseas. And this was all based on Padilla's supposed attendance of an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. The verdict, surprisingly, was reached by the jury after only 1.5 days of deliberation. Ralph?
There are many dimensions to this case. As the Christian Science Monitor made very clear in its article of August 15th, beyond the Padilla terror case huge legal issues, his detention and interrogation raised basic constitutional questions. But the lead paragraph in the Christian Science Monitor report states, Jose Padilla is known worldwide as the man who plotted with al-Qaeda to detonate a radiological dirty bomb in a major city. He allegedly presented his plan to the top al-Qaeda leaders, Abu Zubaydah, and 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But according to U.S. intelligence reports, both men doubted Padilla could pull off the attack. Now, point one. Jose Padilla has in no way ever had any connection to any plan for a radiological dirty bomb in a major U.S. city. There has never been a scintilla of evidence presented by the United States authorities for this bogus charge. Indeed, when they were torturing him, as you mentioned, for 43 months, and we will go into that torture, but it's important to understand what they did to Padilla. They subjected him to total sensory deprivation. They had him in total darkness. They had him without the ability to hear or to see. And they subjected him to mind-altering drugs, and they kept him in this condition where he was totally dissociated, where he engaged in a complete schizophrenic mental breakdown, where he could no longer distinguish interior sounds from exterior sounds, where he could no longer judge whether he was listening to voices inside his head or whether people were speaking to him. Under these conditions of total and absolute and fiendish torture that destroyed the mind of this man, over 43 months of total isolation, 43 months of sensory deprivation, of sleep deprivation, 43 months of his brain being bombarded by mind-altering drugs that left him in states of total panic and dissociation.
And it's been established that this has included LSD and PCP.
And Maya, at the end of all this, the government absolutely dropped any claim to have any evidence about a radiological dirty bomb, and that was dropped totally from the presentation of a case against Jose Padilla. In other words, they took him in on the basis of these inflammatory charges about a radiological dirty bomb, a false terror operation. They imputed these to his supposed his relationship to the, quote, Al-Qaeda masterminds Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed having already been dead, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed having himself, when captured, if captured at all, subjected to the same types of torture. This is indeed this charade of bourgeois legitimacy and legality. And indeed, the beyond the terror case of Padilla, as the Christian Science Monitor indicates, we have here the real techno-architecture of the fascist state. This is the hallmark of the authoritarian state, said Larry Johnson, the former State Department counterterrorism official and former analyst of the Central Intelligence Agencies. At the point at which the government said dirty bomb, he continues, there was no opportunity to respond. Mr. Padilla was in solitary confinement. No lawyer had been able to talk to him about his charges. There was no evidence. There was no crime. In the court of public opinion, the Christian Science Monitor tells us, Padilla stands convicted, his name synonymous with that of a dirty bomber. Yet when it came time to put Padilla on trial, the government's case included no mention whatsoever of a dirty bomb or a dirty bomb plot.
Ralph, it's very important to look at how this trial unfolded in Florida, much in the same way as the trial of attorney Lynn Stewart unfolded in New York, where the prosecution presented hours upon hours, days upon days, weeks upon weeks of supposed evidence to establish a scenario, evidence about Osama bin Laden and tapes played, and in order to inflame the jury, but things that had nothing to do with the case itself. And as in New York, so in Florida, the judge, in this case, Judge Marsha Cook, allowed the prosecution to show a videotape of a 1997 interview with Osama bin Laden, even though it was confirmed in the court that it had no direct relevance to the case. The relevance, of course, was to inflame the jury. And Paul Craig Roberts, it had a very important article that appeared on antiwar.com on August 20th, 2007. Padilla jury opens a Pandora's box. And Paul Craig Roberts goes through an analysis of the case. What he says is, Jose Padilla's conviction on terrorism charges on August 16th was a victory not for justice, but for the U.S. justice, and he puts that as sick. In other words, the so-called U.S. Justice Department's theory that a U.S. citizen can be convicted not for committing a terrorist act, but for allegedly harboring aspirations to commit such an act. By agreeing with the Justice Department's theory, the incompetent Padilla jury delivered a deadly blow to the rule of law and opened a Pandora's box. So this is what he goes through in terms of the analysis of the jury. But first he says, let's look at who this jury was. He says it was a patriotic jury that appeared in court with one row of jurors dressed in red, one in white, and one in blue. And that was noted by the Washington Post correspondent Peter Wariski in his August 17th article. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the jury in red, white, and blue, demonstrating by its behavior its total preconditioned willingness to indict, confirmed this when members of the jury stated that they had made up their minds before they entered the jury box. This was an absolute direct quote from members of the jury, and they collectively decided to wear red, white, and blue in the jury box as you mentioned, Maya, one row red, one row white, and one row blue. You have here not a jury, but a selected number of hanging judges collectively functioning as a pseudo-jury, not prepared to listen to evidence, not interested in the evidence, having already decided that whatever the government told them they would sanction. What does Paul Craig Roberts state? Anglo-American law is a human achievement 800 years in the making. Over centuries, law was transformed from a weapon in the hands of arbitrary government into the shield of people from unaccountable power. The Padilla jury has turned law back into a weapon. And that, from a bourgeois point of view, is well said. Because what we have here is the removal of the facade, the stripping away of any pretense that the artificial application of law matters when targeting those who the ruling class wants to destroy, whether through Phoenix programs, whether through the police occupying, acting as an occupying army in our inner cities, whether from the throwdown weapons with which the police gun down black youth across this United States. The facade of bourgeois law has always had very limited application, but now it is being taken away in all its formality.
Let's look at the so-called evidence that was presented in the case against Jose Padilla and his co-defendants. One, seven intercepted telephone conversations had mention of Jose Padilla or on which he was heard. Two, a 10-year-old non-relevant video of Osama bin Laden that I'd mentioned before. And three, an alleged application to a Mujahideen training camp. And Roberts notes this was not a terrorist training camp. This is similar to the Mujahideen training camps that were funded and supported by the CIA and the British intelligence services during the U.S. plans to break up Afghanistan, in other words, to when the Soviets were influential in Afghanistan. So this supposed application had Jose Padilla's fingerprints. But what's most interesting is that there were many different handwriting samples on this application, and Padilla's fingerprints were not on the front of the application, but were only on the reverse side of the pages.
It's not only that, Maya, but the signatures were not his, and the writing was several handwritings on the front of the form, and of course, where he is supposedly signing his name and filling in the items of the form, the handwriting is different. The handwriting is not his, and there are no fingerprints except on the back of the paper. Obviously, here, as the Christian Monitor itself states, the Christian Science Monitor itself states, while this man was in a state of total disorientation, they put a piece of paper in his hands. Only the back of it touched his fingers, and they filled in the forms themselves. Here is a description. The questioning of Padilla was accompanied by specially authorized harsh interrogation methods, total isolation, sensory deprivation, stress positions, according to the former interrogators. Now, the claims that there were terrorists who were coordinating with Padilla, and indeed Gonzalez was responsible for making the claim that the stream of intelligence would quickly dry up if enemy combatants were allowed contact with outsiders. The result would be the failure to uncover information that would prevent attacks. This would be an intolerable cost, he stated. And what he's referring to here is the supposed what's the expression that was used about the gun that's about to go off? If you don't torture these people, that they are a ticking time bomb that is going to result in a major terror attack within the United States. That is the rationale for torturing people. That is the rationale for faking evidence about people. Let's just take one quick look at the the Christian Science Monitor's description about how they obtained people to testify or to give them evidence that supposedly implicated Jose Padilla, although there was no link between those people and Jose Padilla. One of these individuals, Mohammed, who was interrogated in Pakistan, Morocco, and Afghanistan, described what was done to him. His interrogators, and I'm quoting from the Christian Science Monitor, used the scalpel to make 20 to 30 cuts on his genitals every 3 to 4 weeks for months. But this man had never met Padilla and doesn't know who he is, quote unquote. But to obtain a confession from this person, they use a scalpel, 30 cuts on his genitals every 3 to 4 weeks for months. These are the methods of the fascist state. They are enshrined by not just Gonzales, but by the acceptance of these methods now by the authorities, by the courts, by the Congress, by the verdict, and by this pseudo-jury. Beyond the Padilla case, detention and interrogation raise basic constitutional questions. They raise basic questions about the gangster nature of the capitalist state.
Ralph, the bourgeois press has noted the lack of evidence and the distortion of evidence, just as bourgeois commentators like Paul Craig Roberts. The International Herald Tribune and the Associated Press reported in detail on the so-called telephone intercepts, particularly the one of in their article of June 19, 2007. Quote, accused al-Qaeda operative Jose Padilla was never overheard using purported code words for violent jihad in intercepted telephone conversations and spoke often about his difficulties in learning Arabic while studying in Egypt. The lead FBI case agent testified. The questioning of FBI agent James T. Kavanaugh by Padilla attorney Michael Caruso focused on 7 intercepted telephone calls on which Padilla's voice is heard mostly talking about his marriage and his studies, but never about Islamic extremism. Caruso asked Kavanaugh if Padilla was ever heard using what prosecutors say were code words for violent jihad. No, he does not, Kavanaugh replied. Caruso asked Kavanaugh if Padilla was ever overheard discussing jihad training. No jihad training that I've seen, Kavanaugh said. He's not referring to anything here but studying Arabic, correct? Study means study, right? Caruso asked. That's what they're talking about, Kavanaugh testified. Despite the FBI's testimony and the intercepted telephone messages containing no incriminating evidence, that is, let's note, no evidence. That's why the prosecutor said that Padilla was probably speaking in code, that talking about his marriage, talking about his studies was actually code language for the supposed terrorist operation. This jury accepted the federal prosecutor's unsupported accusation that there were hidden code words in the message indicating that Padilla was a terrorist. After all, Paul Craig Roberts notes, who but a terrorist would want to learn Arabic? Well,
again, I would like to return to the former Reagan cabinet officer, Paul Craig Roberts, who is actually quite eloquent in his description of what is at stake here. He quotes the forensic psychiatrist Dr. Angela Hegarty in the Christian Science Monitor in describing how U.S. interrogators destroyed the mind of Padilla. He describes in detail the sensory deprivation and the sleep deprivation and the isolation and the drugs, to the point where he could no longer distinguish not just voices from inside and outside, but whether those who were speaking to him as his attorneys were the prosecutors or indeed the torturers who were tormenting him. Padilla was arrested 5 years ago in 2002, and the United States government charged he was about to set off a radioactive dirty bomb in a U.S. city that would kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. And this is what Paul Craig Roberts states. The story was a total lie, a fabrication designed to keep the fear levels high in order to keep support for the Bush regime's wars and a domestic police state. None of the charges on which Padilla was illegally held During those years, before the Supreme Court intervened and ordered the Bush treatment to release Padilla or bring him to trial, were ever again part of the charges on which Padilla was tried. It's switch, bait and switch. There is little doubt that Padilla's conviction and the convictions of his two co-defendants is a total and terrible injustice. But the damage done goes far beyond that to the defendants. What this red, white, and blue Padilla jury has done is to overthrow the U.S. Constitution.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State, the Padilla Verdict, Exposing the Facade of the Rule of Law. And we continue with this topic. Let's look at the video that was played by the prosecutor, the 10-year-old video of an interview with Osama bin Laden. The video, besides being 10 years old, makes no reference to any of the three defendants. Moreover, none of the defendants were accused of ever being in contact with Osama bin Laden. The only purpose of the video was to arouse the jurors' fear, their anger, and the disturbing memories associated with September 11, 2001. And you will recall that this is the same tactic used time and again in the trial of attorney Lynn Stewart. The fact that the judge let prosecutors sway this jury with emotion and passion rather than evidence will be grounds for appeal, but still it led to a bogus conviction.
Well, you know, I want to emphasize, I know it may be elaborating on something we've already discussed, but I cannot impress upon our listeners, upon you brothers and sisters, the enormity of what is at stake here. Again, Dr. Angela Hegarty, there was something wrong with Padilla after this detention. There was something weird, something not right. He was a different man. He was in a state of absolute terror, alternating with numbness. He was a trauma victim who knew he would be sent back to the person who hurt him. And this was the first time, Hegarty notes, I had ever met anyone who had been so totally isolated for such an extraordinarily long period of time. Sensory deprivation studies tell us that without sleep, people develop psychotic conditions, symptoms, hallucinations, panic attacks, depression, suicidality within days. But Padilla was in this situation and utterly dependent on interrogators who tortured him for years, for 43 months. For 3 years and 8 months, 7 months, what happened to Padilla, Hegarty states, was the destruction of a human being's mind. I don't think it is possible to overemphasize the enormity of this. Try to imagine, brothers and sisters, how you would withstand a day, 3 days, a week of such treatment, let alone 43 months. The government very deliberately decided that it would not base its case on any statements made by Padilla during the confinement. And why? Because they sought to prevent any discussion of his treatment before the jury. The actual physical evidence presented by the prosecution against Padilla was non-existent. Of 300,000 intercepted phone conversations, the government could produce only 7 that even involved Padilla. And none of these included any so-called code words that the prosecution claimed referred to plans to carry out terrorist attacks. The references to Padilla were completely anodyne, without any implication of anything, by people who had mentioned his name, not in relation to any intended act. Padilla's fingerprints on the outside of the pages. This was the so-called evidence. And the defense did not call any witnesses on Padilla's behalf. Beyond that, the court instructed both the defense and the prosecution not to reveal the treatment of Padilla. Imagine, this trial proceeded without the jury being allowed to know that this man was tortured. This jury was not allowed to know that he was kept in total isolation. This jury was not allowed to know that his mind was destroyed. This jury was not allowed to know that he was without a lawyer. This jury was not allowed to know that he had been treated in a way that only medieval torture chambers in fascist states have treated their victims. And yet, this is called a trial. This is called due process. And this is the basis of a conviction. Top government officials declared Padilla guilty of plotting to commit mass murder before the entire country, with the media filled for weeks in 2002 with details of dirty bombs and the destruction they would inflict. And the prosecution was constantly connecting Padilla to Osama bin Laden, although no evidence was presented to establish such a link. And the judge allowed the prosecution to show videotapes of interviews with bin Laden that had absolutely fake interviews at that, because the interviews on the videotapes are scissors and paste jobs. But leaving that aside, it had no relevance whatsoever with this case. As the World Socialist website notes, the Kafkaesque treatment to which Padilla was subjected as a warning to every American. Such are the conditions that will be meted out to anyone, U.S. citizen or not. According to the legal theory developed by this administration and supported by the Congress, constitutional rights will be sacrificed in the name of the war on terror. This conviction occurs within the context of the vast expansion of dictatorial powers to spy on the population, to deny basic democratic rights, to employ torture on those detained, on those held throughout the world. This, indeed, is the gravamen of the Padilla case.
Ralph, I'm sorry, Ralph.
That's all right, Maya.
I want to mention, because we had discussed that the charges against Padilla were in attending a training camp, a Mujahideen training camp in Afghanistan. And I had mentioned the support of the CIA and British intelligence for these training camps. And in fact, the government alleged that Padilla had attended these training camps in the 1990s. This is when they were under the direct control of the CIA and British intelligence. And the support that Padilla and his co-defendants, the so-called terror campaign that they were allegedly planning, was in support of jihadists in Bosnia and Chechnya. So the timing and the campaigns and the support and the actions, the supposed actions, the alleged actions that never really were proven, all this took place during the time of U.S. and British intelligence support of activities in Afghanistan and the creation of groups such as the group of Osama bin Laden, who was working very closely with the Saudi government and the CIA. And what took place in the Florida courtroom created one falsification heaped upon another falsification to create a false image of what had actually taken place. In their closing arguments, the prosecutors mentioned Al-Qaeda more than 100 times. Al-Qaeda had not even existed at the time frame of when they were talking about Jose Padilla having been in Afghanistan. At that time, these were the Mujahideen. And Al-Qaeda was mentioned more than 100 times, and he urged the jurors to think of Al-Qaeda and groups alleged to be affiliated with it as an international murder conspiracy. Padilla, he said, was, quote, trained to kill. Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian Fraser misinformed the jury in his closing statement. If Padilla wished to kill, and who he wished to kill, was never identified by the prosecution. It was anonymous, but they said he had been wanting to kill these unknown people since 1998. He was convicted for harboring alleged intentions, not for committing any acts. In other words, no harmful acts were ever charged Jose Padilla was not charged for ever having committed any harmful acts. And yet he's going to face a life imprisonment.
Well, Maya, I think we have this theme reiterated here in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Christian Science Monitor, in the Washington Post, in mainstream newspapers that have responded to the Padilla case with a sense of horror, in part because they are, I think, alarmed at the extent to which these methods will arouse the American people, will alienate the American people, and will create a condition in which the ruling class can no longer operate at all in this society, having painted itself into a corner, having removed the mask from its own essentially fascist character. That theme emerges, and I think it's important to note that these newspapers that have supported all of the activities of this regime in one form or another are now fully cognizant of the extent to which this places themselves in danger, and indeed the system that they want to protect in jeopardy itself, because these are methods and these are techniques that do not, in the final analysis, succeed in terrorizing our people as they are intended to do, but in preparing for a mobilization on a scale that will remove this system from power. No system can sustain itself for any extended length of time when it forfeits all pretense at representing the population. And as the Christian Science Monitor documented, as Alan Bock reported in the antiwar.com, and as the stories in Los Angeles Times and the New York Times and the Washington Post make clear, complete isolation, sensory sleep deprivation, no access to a lawyer for any other human being. This is the Christian Science Monitor speaking. These are treatments that we call torture, and they are done by outright police states. These are the words of a series of bourgeois press articles that make clear that it's no longer possible for them to pretend that the society has not entered into a new paradigm. These are the powers, the article cited here by Alan Bock is actually a statement by Yale professor Jack Balkin. It is important to remember that the Bush administration did everything it could to deny Padilla even the basic right of habeas corpus. It is argued that courts have no power to second-guess the president's determination that an enemy of the United States can be held in solitary confinement indefinitely. It is argued that no one has the right to contact Padilla. No one had the right to know what the government was doing to him. That the courts must defer to the president's views about who is dangerous and who is not. That once the president declares a person an enemy, that person has all due process and removed, and the courts have to respect that arbitrary determination. In short, the president will always know best, and if these people have their way, the government will never have to be tested before any neutral magistrate can pluck any citizen off the streets, throw them into military prisons, and proceed to drive them insane. These are the powers that this administration has sought. I will not mince words. They are powers of a dictatorship in an authoritarian regime. They are the powers of Stalin's Soviet Union, of the military junta in Argentina during the time of the disappeared. And that theme, which the Yale professor articulates and which is cited here by Alan Bock, is repeated by Stephen Vladek on August 17th in the editorial in the New York Times called The Lost Padilla Verdict. What should have gone on trial were the administration's methods in detaining a so-called dirty bomber suspect. And it goes into the saga, which he says began 63 months ago, when this man was arrested at an international airport in Chicago and immediately dubbed an enemy combatant by then-Attorney General John Ashcroft, transferred to a military brig, held without charges in solitary confinement, and tortured by his captors. And again, without having to repeat the particularity of these of this torture, which each of these newspapers does not hesitate to cite, it stated the very important fact that the defense and even the prosecution were barred from mentioning the fact of his detention and the manner of his treatment, so that the jury could not know about it and that the court would not be presented with the obligation to throw out the evidence and to release this man immediately, let alone to fail to take action against the perpetrators. And the article in the Los Angeles Times, the editorial cites Justice Robert H. Jackson, who stated the principle and he refers to our the violation of our fundamental rights, lies like a loaded weapon, ready for the hand of any authority that can bring forward a plausible claim of an urgent need. And the editorial continues, the military detention of Jose Padilla and his treatment while detained is indeed a victory for Bush administration that has prevented the courts from acknowledging it and from saying so.
Ralph, we have to say over and again that when President Bush declared Jose Padilla an enemy combatant and said that he could be detained without counsel, without access to his family, for an unlimited time in a Navy brig, and also that interrogation methods were, as the new executive order has allowed, were appropriate. The interrogation methods that are torture, clearly torture, that none of these charges, again and again we have to say, none of these allegations about a radiological dirty bomb plot, again about apartment buildings, or even Padilla's presence in Afghanistan in late 2001, none of these ever saw the light of day in the courtroom in Florida. Instead, the government went into court on a bogus charge with minimal evidence and alleged that Padilla had conspired in the 1990s to provide support to overseas jihadists in Bosnia and Chechnya and Kosovo. Now, this is what was brought into court. Nothing. After 43 months of torturing this man, they went into court with bogus charges on flimsy evidence that all the bourgeois press, all the commentators have exposed as bogus, flimsy, non-existent evidence, and they created an inflamed atmosphere in that courtroom that led the jury to convict Padilla and his co-defendants. And what the prosecutors said specifically to the jury was that they should not look at any individual piece of evidence, but instead look at the generalized picture of the whole.
The law professor at Stanford University, Jenny S. Martinez, who represented Jose Padilla before the Supreme Court in 2004 and is his attorney in a civil case regarding his treatment, wrote for the Washington Post on August 17th an article called The Real Verdict on Jose Padilla. And she stated, for the 2 years that Jose Padilla was denied all access to his lawyers, his family, and his court system, the Bush administration claimed he could be held without trial until the end of its own war on terror. The government stated that allowing Padilla would talk to a lawyer or to know that a court was considering his case would threaten national security. And Padilla, during this entire time, was subjected to sleep deprivation, stress positions, extreme temperatures, held without human contact, without a clock or natural light, with no way to know how quickly or slowly time was passing. When he was removed from his cell, goggles and earmuffs were placed on him. Psychologists have long reported that this extreme sensory deprivation is the quickest way to drive people mad.
And also, we should note, willing to confess anything, which leads to the subject of next week's program, which is the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And Ralph, you wrote about this process in an important article on official murder and capitalist rule in America, the continuing dynamic, which was analysis of the murder, the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy as he was running for president.
And in particular, the Manchurian candidate in mind control to which his falsely accused assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, was subjected. And I'm going to quote from part of that article, the subheading of which was the CIA and mind control. It cites the San Francisco Examiner on September 2, 1977, discussing the CIA's MKUltra mind control program. The program included a study called Operation Artichoke to involuntarily induce people to commit assassinations. W.H. Boart, who wrote a very important book on the subject of called Operation Mind Control, devoted four chapters to case studies of CIA, Office of Naval Intelligence, and other governmental agency programs undertaken for the purpose of conditioning subjects to become political assassins. Quote, in July 1975, the Sunday Times in London quoted a U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence had taken convicted murderers from military prisons, conditioned them as political assassins, and placed them in American embassies around the world. In Bowert's four chapters, A School for Assassins, The Face of a Zombie, The Lone Nuts, Another Hypnopatsy, the specific and documented instances in which individuals were subjected to deep hypnosis and programmed to carry out political assassinations are set forth. Similarly, John Marks, the co-author with Victor Marchetti of the CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, examined this subject specifically in the book The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, The CIA and Mind Control, the story of the agency's secret efforts to control human behavior. It is described at length in a chapter called Brainwashing, which is an account of Dr. Hewan Cameron's protracted governmental program of, quote, de-patterning, unquote, defined as, quote, breaking up existing patterns of behavior by means of particularly intensive electroshocks combined with prolonged drug-induced sleep. Here was a psychiatrist, willing and indeed eager to wipe the human mind totally clean, creating such a state in which a man who knew too much could be made to forget, had long been a prime objective of the Artichoke and MK-Ultra programs, unquote. That's on page 133. Apart from hypnosis, these government programs were carried out over decades on human subjects. Quote, in standard professional electroshock, doctors gave the subject a single dose of 110 volts lasting a fraction of a second once a day or every other day. By contrast, Cameron used a form 20 to 40 times more intense, two or three times daily, with the power turned up to 150 volts. The frequent screams that echoed through the hospital did not deter Cameron or his associates in their attempts to, quote, de-pattern, unquote, their subjects completely, unquote, page 135. Martin Cannon reaches similar findings in his study, The Controllers, Mind Control and Project MK-Ultra, in 1994. Not unreasonably, having described the sustained programming to which living people are subjected and the behaviors they've been induced to manifest unawares, Cannon concludes the following, quote, a specter haunts the democratic nations, the specter of techno-fascism. All the powers of the espionage empire and its scientific establishment have entered into an unholy alliance to invoke this specter. Psychiatrist and spy, Dulles and Delgado, specialists and clandestine operators, a mind is a terrible thing to waste and a worse thing to commandeer, unquote. Padilla, the false flag terror operation of 9/11, the preparations for dictatorial rule and indeed martial law in the United States, the executive order of July 17th that prepares for the rounding up of U.S. citizens if they so much as support opposition to the policies in Iraq, these indeed are the hallmarks of a capitalist system in terminal decay that is waging war not only on the peoples of the world, but upon the people of the United States, first and foremost, brothers and sisters. That is the gravamen of this series. We will continue it next week. It is indeed the constitutional destruction of our rights, or rather the destruction, I should put it more correctly, of our constitutional rights. And it is indeed the signal that we must find a way to mobilize our people not merely to resist, but to overthrow this vicious system in terminal decay.
Remember, what they do depends on our actions, our resistance. What they can get away with depends upon the level of our resistance. We can overcome. We shall overcome. And in that light, I'd like to mention that September 15th, there's a large anti-war demonstration taking place in Washington, D.C., and Ralph and I will be speaking at Cooper Union at the New York 9/11 Truth Movement events the weekend prior Please look at the New York 9/11 Truth website for the details about the two-day conference. And again, we will be at the September 11th rally in Washington, D.C. Our program today, The Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State, is part of an ongoing series which is available on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Today's edition, The Padilla Verdict, Exposing the Facade of the Rule of Law, will be up on our website. And please also check out the WBAI website, www.wbai.org. We'd like to hear from you. Contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net. Again, we'll be with you next week.
Oh,